Well, it's great to be here with you today, and I know that there's a small barrier between me and lunch. So we're looking forward to enlightening you, hopefully, in what we're seeing as some of the new approaches to addressing the health hazards. At the top of this slide, these are actually enamel badges, photographs taken by Earl Dotter, who is an APH friend. And you can see the one on the top left is actually a worker, a woman who worked at Johns Manville's. And you'll see later on why each of these four enamel badges plays into the history of what we're trying to solve now. Part of my conversation and discussion with you is really going to be touching on five aspects, and I think looking at my late husband, at the time that Alan was diagnosed, we had never heard of mesothelioma. We, too, had thought asbestos had been banned. Alan did not work as in the trades, per se. He was an environmental engineer, and he came as a total surprise to us. So, using our personal experience and my professional experience, I want to highlight on some of the areas that we have been focusing on, obviously, to reduce exposure, shape policy, and move this across. I'm going to share with you some historical data and also look at some of the barriers to prevention, which I think is really important for all issues, in fact, the other four discussions here, because we really see barriers and obstacles that we have to overcome. And looking at traditional and digital media to obviously advance education, and with awareness comes education and then hopefully policy changes. It's true, I'm the co-founder of ADIL. I have no disclosures to make, and we are really focused on education, advocacy, and community. We knew at the time of Alan's diagnosis that this organization would not change Alan's outcome. He did die with my then 13-year-old daughter by his side after fighting a 3-year battle, but we did know that we had seen some policy changes from the time Alan was diagnosed to the time he passed away, that the core values of what we started would make a difference in the homes of Americans in Washington and literally with United Nations and around the world. But how are we going to change the discussion? Asbestos, as all of you know, as public health leaders, it's a nearly invisible fiber. You can't see it, taste it, touch it, smell it. And as Celeste and I have done, we've had many Hill meetings. These staffers are very young. They don't have a public health background. And we found that we needed a graphic to really drive this message home so they could understand what workers were facing. And obviously, there's non-occupational exposure as well. Under President Lincoln's nose, you can see the 20,000 asbestos fibers compared to grains of rice and human hair. And this graphic, I think, will illuminate and drive forward some of the other points for today's discussion. And the staffers do sit up straighter in their chair when they see this, and they recognize it could be a threat to them as well. This slide, I think, is important. It's from Dr. Jim Weber. It actually shows you asbestos fibers embedded into lung tissue. Now, we know that up to 12,000 to 15,000 Americans die every year. That's every year from preventable asbestos-caused diseases. And clearly, it's commonly thought of as in four diseases of asbestosis, mesothelioma, lung cancer, and pleural thickening. And that's important because we want to reach those who may have been exposed, high-risk occupations, and focus on the four diseases that really get enough public health attention. Now, I don't know how many of you know this, but I think it's staggering to me as a mesothelioma widow to know that asbestos has been the leading cause of occupational cancers, and it's the second most fatal carcinogen after tobacco that's been man-made. So let's take a look at the toxic trade, because we know if we can ruin one element of the trade, this cycle collapses. Mining, manufacturing, and commerce, both within the United States and around the world. This is a photograph from Asbestos Quebec that I took. These are pallets of bags of chrysotile asbestos awaiting to be shipped, yes, to the United States and around the world. We in the United States have a terrible legacy of asbestos use. If you look at USGS data from 1900 to 2015, we've actually consumed, that's the word USGS uses, we've used 31 million metric tons. And that's important because some of the studies that I'm going to cite are going to, you'll understand the risk and the hazards because of our overwhelmingly large consumption. I want to touch on the three waves. I want to break it apart to an area that you can actually see from those first enamel badges what these waves look like to the workers and their families. This photograph is from the Jeffrey Mine in Canada that we toured, and you can see the depth of mining The tailing piles are not piles, they are mountains that are off to the side. Not only does the mining create a problem for the workers, but also an environmental disaster that soon has to be remediated. Looking at wave one of manufacturing, of mining and manufacturing, you can see this worker here. Now, none of these workers obviously really were warned about the health risks of asbestos. And wave two were the workers that went in and took those manufactured contaminated products and put them into airplanes, into homes, into brakes. You see Firestone, Westinghouse. This really paints the picture of how these workers had to use asbestos-contaminated products during the Industrial Revolution. The secondary wave is probably most important to us in the United States, but it's also important around the world. I consider the secondary wave actually to be commonly the do-it-yourself exposures, renovations, demolitions, but we need to focus on natural and man-made disasters. This is an Earl Dodder slide showing the health impact from 9/11, that tragic event. You can see the dust and debris. And of course, we have an ongoing health crisis from those brave first responders and firefighters in wave three. But here's a part that you may not be familiar with. There's something that I call deadly hugs when I test in front of Congress. Because it's not just the worker who's been exposed, it's the take-home exposure from the wife possibly doing the laundry or the children hugging their parent. Michael died when he was 29 and Janelle at 39 from preventable mesothelioma, from hugging their parent. Now, how can this take place? Well, the first patent on asbestos was given from our patent office in 1828. But we see these barriers to prevention that could probably be used for other health issues. But we know there's a common misconception that asbestos had been banned. Our family fell into that. The latency of disease from 10 to 50 years, that also impacted our family because most people look for a direct correlation from exposure to developing a disease. We have weak policy in the United States. We failed to ban asbestos, although it's been tried. The EPA failed. It's no doubt that the toxic chemical industry influence is huge. We saw that in the APHA booth section with American Chemistry Council touting their lovely chlorine, and they're the highest users of asbestos now. Propaganda and misinformation, that circles silica as well, any of these health disasters, because the industry wants to protect their underlying bottom line. And of course, litigation often is a very sad part of this, because most people think that it's people care because it's litigated. And that's clearly not true when 12 to 15,000 people are dying every year. I could spend hours talking about the consumption chart, but I want to touch on these 5 points because I think it gives relativity to the rest of the presentation. If you look on the leftmost side in 1906, that's when the first asbestos case was really recognized in the UK. In 1924, Dr. Cook actually named asbestosis. It was identified in workers, and he actually coined the name. Everyone here knows Dr. Selikoff, but I want you to look at the consumption line. As we're going up, the white line is consumption, and we have significant scientific findings, and it's written in literature about asbestos. In the United States in 1973, we actually consumed a record high of 803,000 metric tons in a year. So the EPA, as you can see, at 1989, down at the low point of the graph, shows when they tried to ban asbestos, which was overturned. It looks like we flatlined out and we have nothing to worry about. That's not true. So from 2000 to present day, we still have consumed over 55,000 metric tons of asbestos, which we're still importing it today. Using CDC data and the NORMS database, there are huge data gaps with asbestos-caused diseases. I actually think it's slightly convenient, but looking at the CDC data, you can actually see that it really wasn't reported when we're going through it. It's very hard to get any data before 1968. So looking at this number, remember there are four diseases that are commonly associated to asbestos exposure. I'm going to show you CDC data for just two of them. And this is the line chart for asbestosis, which is still a very high death rate. Mesothelioma is still going up in the United States. And unfortunately, CDC coding, you can see ICD coding, you can see that they only started collecting database in 1999. So this really doesn't reflect the human cost of inaction. Every year it's commonly used that 3,000 Americans die, and that's obviously far larger around the world. The NIOSH study, I think, is really important. It came out in 2013, late in the year. And the study confirmed that firefighters in the study had a rate of mesothelioma 2 times greater than the rate in the U.S. population. That goes back to our heavy consumption, which is in buildings, cars, and environmental exposure. But that's really significant for 9/11 and other areas. This study just came out about a month ago, and it's the Global Burden of Disease Study funded by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. This is really important because it was commonly thought of in the World Health Organization sites that every year 107,000 is primarily workers die of asbestos-caused diseases. But this study actually reported that instead there were 194,000 deaths in 2013 from asbestos-caused diseases. That represents an 80% increase over the World Health Organization number. So looking at who's using it, who's mining, who's producing, I had my intern go back and we compared population with those who were heavy users and producers, and you can see these 8 countries actually represent 45% of the global population, and they're the top users and producers. So it's really important for this presentation for you to understand that what we do in the United States impacts developing countries, and what we don't do impacts them even more. Clearly, this is quite simple, but it seems to be difficult for Congress to understand. The only 2 ways to end this are prevention and a cure. You can see the spindly fibers under a microscope. So looking at these 4 areas of prevention movements in the 21st century, I wanted just to highlight on these 4, because if we can really work with all 4 together, awareness, education, management, and the trade cycle, we can really develop a significant movement that's sustainable. And I believe that's what our organization has really, it's been the cornerstone of what we've been able to use to make traction in Washington, but also AFL-CIO and other trade unions around the world. There is still a disconnect about asbestos. I mean, I would ask, and I ask members of Congress, do you know where it is in your home, your community, in the Capitol? And they all sheet over with like white eyes. Well, just on Friday, in the Cannon Building, they had another asbestos exposure during renovation. So it's a very common misconception where people don't understand what it is, where it is, and what they can do. So clearly, management is a significant part that we've invested a lot of our time on, because we believe that education, compliance, and enforcement is so significant. Even when we do finally get a ban, we have a lot of work to do after we have consumed 31 million tons of asbestos. The trade cycle is significant. If the United States didn't import asbestos, if we no longer purchased that, that would send a very big signal to Russia, who mines a million tons a year. Total mining is 2 million with the other combined countries. Well, this brings it to, I think for me, it's the most exciting point. We have a historical disaster that outweighs tobacco that we can't get rid of, and 15,000 Americans die every year. So looking at what are the trends and how can we best use this information so that we can enter the workplace and in homes is clearly through social media. Now, looking at the Pew Research Center, they did a great survey, and I'm happy to give you guys all direct links if anybody wants any of this, but it's significant to know that 65% of the adults now use social networking sites. And that's a tenfold jump just in the past decade. The University of Massachusetts in Dartmouth actually did a social media study. And it's 80% of the charities are actually using one form of social media. And you can see these high numbers that we as nonprofits have to use social media because we have budgetary restrictions. We also have a population we need to reach rather quickly. And I think this bodes well for all of us here at APH to maximize the different sections and recognize that this University of Massachusetts study gives us invaluable data that really substantiates our work with social media. Activism has changed. It's changed dramatically in the last 100 years. I like to define to people that there are 2 types. They're both equally valuable. But looking at the work we do, I've really seen a difference between traditional and digital activism. Clearly in the purple, you're very familiar of these types. For instance, Mothers Against Drunk Driving would be a traditional one, a very strong organizational structure with strong ties. But they were also very visible. So anybody that's visible in the limelight of activism can actually suffer a personal consequence if, obviously, if the industry chooses to. Digital activism I find really interesting because most of my interns are 22 or younger, and they want to make the world a better place. They don't care about the dollar, they care about the social good. And they're really to get involved with digital activism, and I would encourage APHA to really invest in digital activism because you can't have one without the other, and this younger generation is really significant in raising awareness and also social action. So looking at the communication style, I think is important because we use micro messaging and macro and multimedia and different styles to reach our point. The campaigns I'm going to touch on very briefly are these five that show how we've been able to use digital versus traditional. We used Raise Your Voice with quotes and photographs all in the month of September, circled the globe. Earl Dotter and I just presented at Harvard, so we have to have a level of engagement and interest with photographs of these workers so that you can drive home the message. In Indonesia, a rural campaign was led by foreign students. In Turkey, of course, these students did one at the university and a traditional one in Pakistan. And in closing, we don't have a ban, so our legislative overview means that we need APHA to step up with us and continue the work that we're doing to ban asbestos. And clearly, Margaret Mead was right. Never doubt the small group of thoughtful people really can change the world. Thank you.
Thank you. Now I'd like to ask our speakers to come back up, and they'll take any questions that you have. I think we had five very different talks, but I think they all have aspects that we can. I learned a lot, and I was weaving things together, and I thought, oh, I can use a part of this over here in this area, and I can use it that. So if anybody has any questions. Yes, sir.
This is a technical thing for the person who's taken. Oh, yeah, and outcomes. Sorry, this is a right meeting. So this is more technical stuff about the first one. When you were doing it by occupational codes, did you use the imputation methods?
No, we used a direct linkage with the SOC codes that were available in the National Health Interview Survey and available in ONET. The problem was that ONET had a more detailed code than NHIS did. So if we didn't get a complete match, then we excluded those from the analysis.